For most of its life in exile, the MKO was financed by Saddam Hussein. After his fall, the group has desperately been looking for a new sponsor, but has always denied it is financed by Saudi Arabia. Yet when the former Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, attended the group's 2016 rally in Paris and called for the fall of the Iranian regime, it raised suspicions again about the role of Riyadh as the sponsor of this terrorist group. According to Ervand Ebrahimian, a professor at the City of University of New York, the money definitely comes from the Saudis. There is no one else who could be subsidizing them with this level of finance. In an article published in 2018, Al-Bawaba revealed that 3 tons of gold ingots and 4 suitcases of Rolex watches were given to the MKO by the Saudis when the group was still in Iraq. To sum up, the MKO is the epitome of hypocrisy, the enemy of the people, with the blood of thousands of innocent people on its hands. It seeks to present itself as a group in exile that fights for the freedom of the Iranian people. The group reveals hypocrisy at a higher level, whitewashing this cult of terror to further policies against Tehran. This is a textbook example of hypocrisy by the self-proclaimed champions of democracy.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَجَعَلْنَا ابْنَ مَرْيَمَ وَأُمَّهُ آيَةً
And we made the son of Mary and his mother a sign, and sheltered them within a high ground, having level areas and flowing water.
As you were with us, we were talking about the 50th verse of chapter Mu'minun. وَجَعَلْنَا بْنَ مَرْيَمَ وَأُمَّهُ آيَةً وَأَوَيْنَاهُمَا إِلَىٰ رَبْوَةٍ ذَاتِ قَرَارٍ وَمَعِينٍ. We made the son of Mary and his mother a sign, and we sheltered them upon a height quiet, secure and watered by a stream. Previously we mentioned why he is called Ibn Maryam, Prophet Jesus, and why his name precedes that of his mother. But the interesting thing is that the calling him son of Mary draws our attention to the fact that he was conceived without participation of a father. And since this exceptional birth is related to both Jesus and his mother, both of them are counted as one sign, because his mother herself had an exceptional birth and was also exceptionally pure. They were in fact one truth in two different aspects. وَجَعَلْنَا بْنَ مَرْيَمَ أُمَّهُ آيَةً. They are together, are called as one ayah and one sign. So different happenings of the universe throughout the history and strange events must be considered as seen as a means to reach the Almighty Allah's power, to understand how powerful He is, and to rely on Him in different hardships in our lives. Anyway, the verse mentions some of the blessings and favors bestowed upon Jesus and His mother. وَأَوَيْنَاهُمَا إِلَىٰ رَبْوَةٍ ذَاتِ قَرَارٍ وَمَعِينٍ. We sheltered them upon a height quiet, secure and watered by a stream. In this part of the verse, two important aspects of life in this world are mentioned. Water and security are from the necessities of living. But the Arabic word rabwa is derived from the word riba, meaning excess and increase. Here, it means a high land. The Quranic word ma'in means the flow of water. So, ma'in means running water. Some have considered it to be derived from the word ayn, meaning water, that is not hidden and can be discerned by eye. This sentence conveys to us the safe, comfortable and peaceful place that Allah gave his mother, so that they would be safe from the plots of their enemies and could fulfill their duties peacefully.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The opinions of the interpreters are divided on the location of this site where this verse is mentioning. Some believe that Nazareth was the hometown of Jesus, ala nabina wa alihi wa alayhi salam. From the time of his birth, some of the enemies that knew about his birth and his future role plotted to murder him. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala saved him and his mother by taking them away from their hometown and sending them to this secure place, which was full of blessings. Some say that it refers to Egypt, because Jesus and his mother had spent part of their lifetimes there, but it's only a probability. Another viewpoint, though, is that the site was in a desert in Palestine, and Allah had made it peaceful and safe for the mother and child by causing water to flow and provided them food from a dried-up date palm. However, this verse shows that Allah constantly supports His messengers and those who support them. Of course, the place where this verse is talking about is of great importance. But that's not the point the verse was sent down. When we deserve the protection of Allah, it would not matter whether or not all of our enemies combine against us. They would not have any power to harm us if He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, does not will it. The other and last point regarding this verse, dear listeners, to be noted, is that being isolated and lacking a physical support, or having only a few defenders, are no indicators of defeat. We should always stay hopeful of the Almighty Allah's help, and we should continue to try and strive in Almighty Allah's favor. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. Your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@IRIB.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is
Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
سعی بکنیم خونه رو تبدیل بکنیم به یه خونه با صفا و با صمیمیت. خونه امیرالمومنین و حضرت زهرا چنین بود.
We must do our best to establish a serene and pleasant atmosphere inside our houses. It is related that the house of Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatimah al-Zahra was such. It is also mentioned that sometimes they took their food to the garden of Imam Ali to sit together and eat. They made a happy and pleasant atmosphere inside their house with respect from both sides. Imam Ali and Hazrat Fatima taught their children to live peacefully too. Once, the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, asked Imam Ali alayhi salam, "How did you find Fatima to Zahra?" Imam Ali replied, "Fatima is a help in my servitude to Allah."
یعنی زنان مردان همسران کمک همدیگه باشید تو بهشتی کردن همدیگه.
This sentence of Imam Ali alayhi salam means that their spouses must attempt to make each other heavenly. Unfortunately, in today's world, some women complain about their husbands and say, "When we were single at the house of our fathers, we observed our hijab and we acted according to the Islamic rulings. When we got married, our husbands asked us to put away the hijab in front of the non-mahram or talk openly with the stranger man." From this claim of some of the Muslim women, we understand that sometimes the spouses make each other go to hellfire. However, it is ordered in Islam that wife and husband must help each other in servitude to Allah and do not violate his rules. Women must act like Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra, who helped Imam Ali alayhi salam in his servitude to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
On April 14th, U.S. President Joe Biden announced one of his biggest decisions since he came to office.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
Biden delivered his address in the White House Treaty Room, where George W. Bush announced the U.S.-led attack on Afghanistan back in 2001.
We need to maneuver on them, or we need somebody else to maneuver on them.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
Between these two statements lie 20 years of war and terror. The chief U.S. goal was to hunt down Osama bin Laden. The U.S. had determined that bin Laden and his network were responsible for the September 11th attacks. But there was never a clear exit strategy, even after the Americans killed bin Laden in May 2011 in Pakistan. U.S. combat operations officially began in early October 2001 with airstrikes against al-Qaeda training camps and Taliban military installations. Under pressure from American air power and an anti-Taliban coalition of Afghans and tribal leaders, the Taliban government collapsed in December. The U.S. flatly refused to negotiate with the toppled officials, sowing seeds for new waves of violence and terror. In the words of Afghanistan expert Ibrahim Bahis, once you have overthrown a force that was ruling over the country and replaced it with a disparate group of actors with diverging priorities and capabilities, seems like there really is very little choice other than to engage in some ways to keep the country from falling apart. The war the Americans staged in Afghanistan was, to a great degree, a serious attempt to undo what they had done in the heat of the Cold War. In the early 1980s, the Americans trained, armed, and financed assorted Afghan Arab groups who fought under the umbrella name of Mujahideen against the occupying Soviet forces. The Afghan Arab fighters later transformed into more distinguished groups, such as the Taliban and al-Qaeda. By the time Soviet forces retreated from the country in 1989, the Taliban had become a powerful group, and by 1996, they held power over roughly three-quarters of Afghanistan. In short, Washington's aim was to tame the creations of its policy that had run amok. But taming the group was easier said than done, costly, bloody, and almost impossible. Brown University's Costs of War project has also estimated that U.S. military expenses in Afghanistan have exceeded $2.26 trillion. According to the UN Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, over the past 12 years, over 111,000 civilians have been killed or injured. Besides the Taliban, international troops have also killed many innocent civilians, especially when attacking villages with fighter jets and drones. The Afghans have had to bear the brunt of Washington's strategic mistakes and miscalculations. At the same time, the resurgent Taliban now control or contest more territory than at any time since the war began, ignoring calls for a ceasefire or at least a reduction in violence.
More than 50 of Afghanistan's 370 districts have fallen since the beginning of May. Most districts have been taken surround provincial capitals, suggesting that the Taliban are positioning themselves to try and take these capitals once foreign forces are fully withdrawn.
Against such a backdrop, Biden's promise to leave Afghanistan for good, regardless of the conditions on the ground, has lessened the incentive for the Taliban to make concessions as the group sees itself the winner of the war. In other words, the Taliban have achieved one of their main goals, the unconditional withdrawal of international troops.
The administration has decided to abandon U.S. efforts in Afghanistan, which have helped keep radical Islamic terrorism in check. And bizarrely, they've decided to do so by September the 11th. apparently we're to help our adversaries ring in the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks by gift wrapping the country and handing it right back to them. Unfortunately, this mistake in Afghanistan is one of several instances of this new administration surrendering leverage without making America, our allies, or our interests more secure.
Living in a time line where we are not anywhere with the negotiations, or we haven't received an agreement with the Taliban, would not be responsible, and it would can cost us losing everything we worked and fought together in the past 20 years, and that can risk overall security in Afghanistan. So that's why I think the extension is a responsible approach for what's happening here now in Afghanistan.
When the US invaded Afghanistan in October 2001, the country was an isolated, devastated country under the Taliban's control. Two decades later, the country has not found peace and is marked with deep social and economic divisions. More than half of the population continues to live in abject poverty.
It's very naive to think that Americans came here to do anything with poverty, to do anything with peace building, to do anything with democracy or human rights. In fact, it's the other way around. The American presence, not in Afghanistan, but in the region and in the world, in the bigger picture, is to create more conflict, is to create more poverty, is to create more dependency to the United States.
The contested areas in the south and east of the country, the heartland of the Taliban, are in bad shape after bearing the brunt of Western firepower. Experts say escalating violence and the COVID-19 pandemic could push the poverty rate from nearly 50% to over 70%. Meanwhile, U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that the Afghan government could collapse within 6 months of the departure of the last international troops. U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan seems to be more than a mere withdrawal. The Americans are in fact running away from Afghanistan, shirking responsibility of cleaning up the mess they've left behind over the past two decades. In a war that has run for more than 20 years, longer than World War I, World War II, and the Korean War combined, the US military in the end tasted humility while leaving the Afghans all to their own devices.
But we don't have a good history of taking care of those who sided with us in conflict and making sure that if they feel they cannot sustain themselves in their country or unwilling to do so, that we take care of them. And that sends a global message. Don't fight with the Americans, because when they're finished, they leave you behind. That's not something we can tolerate.
Will Afghanistan go back to square one when the Taliban were in power? And if so, who is to be blamed?
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. In this episode, we are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws of miscellaneous nature according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for a man and his wife to see each other naked or to drive pleasure from each other like this, for example, or to take a shower together and enjoy themselves?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it is permissible for a man and his wife to see each other naked and, of course, to drive all kinds of pleasures from each other and also to take shower together. But Ayatollah Sistani has said, as far as I know, that it is while a person has sexual intercourse, it's not good to look at a wife's private part directly, you know, seeing it. And it is, though it's not haram, you know, but
It's not recommended.
But it's not recommended. It has been discouraged, and it's not good, you know. But if a person does it, he is not sinning. It is still permissible.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see when it comes to taking shower together, of course, it's permissible. Or maybe if a woman wants to her husband to, let's say, to give her a massage, for example, it is permissible. He can or she can look at, both of them can look at each other's body without having to cover themselves. You see, they are husband and wife, actually.
Yes. Okay. So, concerning this situation, if the man is not in the mood, for example, to have sexual intercourse with his wife, can he basically use his hands to masturbate his wife or even use external objects to stimulate his wife?
Indeed, this is one of the most frequently asked questions, you know. there are some people who are willing to use external objects, foreign objects, you know, to stimulate or to give pleasure to each other. The Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it's not permissible to use any such foreign items or external device, you know, device to stimulate the wife or the husband. So it's haram, you know. This is the opinion held by Ayatollah Sistani. But when it comes to using one's hand or to using one's body parts, there is no objection. For example, let's say if the wife is not in the mood, you know, to have sexual intercourse, she can use her hand to stimulate her husband. Mm-hmm. And the same is the case with the wife. The husband can also do the same thing with his wife, and of course. That is absolutely permissible, and there's no objection to them using their hands and their body parts. But as far as the foreign tools or external device is concerned, it's not permissible. There are different devices, you know, there are different tools with which they can do this, but and they are found in them on the market, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But Muslims cannot use them.
I see. Is it because they are not recommended or impermissible, basically, or haram to use such external objects?
You know, these two terms, impermissible and haram, they are used interchangeably.
Yes.
And when we use impermissible, it means that it gives the same sense. It means that it's haram to use tools and device like these, you know, like
this. I
see.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Can a woman in Janaba recite the Holy Quran?
Of course, a woman in Janaba can recite the Holy Quran, and she can recite all parts of the Quran and all surahs of the Quran except for those four verses of the Quran which are haram for her to recite, you know?
The verses of those four chapters or the whole chapters?
Yeah. Those four verses, according to Ayatollah Sistani, but here we have different scholars with different opinions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that only those four verses are haram to recite for a woman in menses, for a woman in Janaba, or for a man in Janaba, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there are some Shia scholars who are of the view that it's not permissible to recite even one letter or one verse of the whole chapter. So this is a matter of discrepancy, a matter in which Muslim scholars do not have the same opinion. In other words, Muslim scholars have different opinions in this regard, and there is no consensus about it. As far as other things are concerned, like, for example, when it comes to entering a mosque or halting in a mosque, pausing in a mosque, touching this the script of the Holy Quran, touching holy names, sacred names are concerned, of course, all the scholars are of the view that it is haram for a woman to make her body reach these things, to the script of the Holy Quran, or those holy names, you see.
And what about the wall of the mosque? Because we know that the walls of the mosque are built like near the streets. So if one touches, like in the state of Janaba, touches, like leans against, for example, the wall of the mosque, is it permissible?
You know, because
again?
The walls, you know, the, as far as the interior and the interior walls, the exterior wall is concerned, the exterior wall is not a part of the mosque. You know, you can touch it. And it doesn't matter, you know.
No, sometimes the mosques don't have any external or internal walls. They are like the rooms are only like segmented from the street. With the wall, is like shared between like the outside part of it, the street. The inside is the room of the mosque.
Yeah. What is said about women, about people in Janaba or women in menstruation, goes or refers to the interior or to the inside of the mosque, you know. A woman in Janaba or in mens is not allowed to enter a mosque and stay there or halt there. But if she enters from one gate, from one door, and goes out of another door without pausing there is no problem. As far as Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi is concerned, of course, it's absolutely forbidden to enter these two mosques because they are the holiest mosques for all Muslims.
What about the shrines of A'imah?
Of course, when it comes to the shrines also, it is not permissible for women to go to that room where the chamber is. The chamber is.
But the yard is not.
The yard is concerned.
The courtyard.
Yeah, as for those parts which are not considered to be mosques, you know, because there are some... There some rooms are considered to be part of a mosque, you know. Like when you go to Mashhad, you will see there are some parts of the shrine which are considered as mosques. And for women, it's not permissible for women as who are in the state of menstruation or in Janaba to enter those places which are considered as mosques. But as far as the porches are concerned, the corridors are concerned, and the lobbies are concerned, those places which are not part of the mosque and nor part of the room in which the chamber lies, so there is no problem and no objection to women going and walking into these places.
What about the Husainiyas?
The Husainiyah, there is no the rules applying to the mosques do not apply to the Husainiyas, and of course women.
And the difference is actually that formula that should be pronounced, like for a mosque to be called a mosque.
Yes. That is the difference. You know, Husainiyah is not considered to be a mosque. It's permissible for women to go there, to sit there, and to engage in dua and supplications, even when they are in the state of Janaba.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alim La ilaha illa hum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illa.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. This is your host, Musa Al-Bahadli, from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us yet again. Today's topic or question is maybe controversial to some, but answering it is very vital to our Shia school of thought. And the question is as follows. Sunni Muslims and Wahhabis, we make a distinction between these two, of course. They are not the same sect. In order to make the relations between Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salam, the household of the Prophet, and the Caliphs, the Khulafa, appear good and friendly, they often refer to a narration which they attribute to Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, alayhi salam, who, regarding Abu Bakr, the first Caliph, said the following, وَلَّدَنِي أَبُو بَكْرٍ مَرَّتَيْنِ, translating to English, meaning, Abu Bakr gave birth to me, of course, figuratively, twice. Is this narration legitimate and therefore is not fabricated, or do we actually have this in our Shia sources?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So the people who have mentioned this narration, as you mentioned, they want to say that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in this narration is somehow boasting of himself, and he's telling the people that I'm proud of the fact that Abu Bakr has given birth to me twice, of course, as you mentioned, figuratively. So it means that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is somehow respecting the first caliph, and he's boastful of the fact that he is from his generation.
He's praising him.
Yeah, and the claims of the Shia that the relations between Imam Hadi alayhi salam, the other imams, and the caliphs was not good at all is baseless. So we need to, see the source of this narration. The narration which reads, Inna Abu Bakr waladani marratain, first of all, what is the meaning of this narration? Why, according to this narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said that Abu Bakr has given birth to me twice?
So first you must understand it, yeah. Which makes sense.
The reason is that the mother of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that is Umm Farwa, from her father and from her mother, from both sides, she goes back to Abu Bakr, and this is something true. Because the mother of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was Umm Farwa. Umm Farwa, her father is Qasim. Qasim is the son of Muhammad, and Muhammad is son of Abu Bakr, the first caliph. So this is from her father's side. From her mother's side, the mother of Umm Farwa is Asma, the daughter of Abdul Rahman, and Abdul Rahman is son of Abu Bakr. So according to this argument, this is the reason why Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is referring and mentioning that Abu Bakr has given birth to me twice.
So they're related by blood, basically.
Yeah. Now, first of all, this narration has not been mentioned by any Shia scholar except for one Shia scholar. And that is Abu al-Fahd Erbili in his famous book, Kashf al-Ghumma. But in that book, he is quoting from a Sunni scholar. So the first answer is that it is not mentioned in any Shia source, narrating from the companions of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, quoting from one of the Imams. So
we do not accept it.
Yeah. Being a Shia, we do not accept this narration, and we do not need to answer to a narration which is mentioned in Sunni sources.
Of course.
This is the first answer. The second answer is that when we refer to this narration in Kashf al-Ghumma, as I mentioned, he is quoting from a Sunni scholar. The narrator of this narration is Hafiz Abdul Aziz. He says that قَالَ أَبُو عَبْدُ اللَّهِ جَعْفَرَ بْنُ مُحَمَّدْ لَقَدْ وَرَدَنِي أَبُو بَكْرٍ مَرَّتَيْنِ. So the narrator of this narration is Hafiz Abdul Aziz, who passed away in 611. We know that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was martyred in 148. So okay, the gap between the two is about 463 years. And according to the criteria in Ilm al-Rijal, which are accepted by Ilm al-Diraya, which are accepted by both Shia and Sunni scholars, this is a mursal narration. I mean, a man is narrating a narration with about 5 centuries gap between the two, without referring to other narrators in between.
Seems perhaps so unlikely.
Exactly. So it's not an authentic, the chain of the narration is not authentic at all.
It is weak than the chain of transmission.
The next point is that when we refer to Sunni sources, we see that again, according to the Rijali rulings of Ahlul Sunnah, it is a weak narration as well.
Okay.
In the chain of the narration that is mentioned in Sunni sources, there are some people like Abu al-Barakat, Abdul Samad bin Ali, Ahmad bin Muhammad bin Ismail, and Hafs ibn Ghiyath. According to Sunni scholars, these are majhul or unknown.
Unknown narrators.
Yeah, unknown narrators. So even if we refer to the Sunni sources, we see that this narration is not authentic at all. The next point is that, as I mentioned, we cannot reject the fact that Imam alayhi salam was not happy with the caliph. Lady Fatima al-Zahra salam alayhi, she was never happy with the first caliph and the second caliph.
Even if we accept this narration, actually.
Of course, we do not accept, and my point is that when we refer to the life and the narrations of Imam alayhi salam and Fatima al-Zahra salam alayha, we come to this conclusion that they were completely angry with the first, especially two caliphs.
So contradict this narration.
And bearing that in mind, how is it possible for Imam Sadiq alayhi salam to boast of being from the generation of the first caliph?
Makes no logical sense.
It doesn't make sense. While he knows that how Fatima al-Zahra salamu alayha was angry with the first caliph, Abu Bakr. Let me share some narrations from Sunni sources in this regard. It's been mentioned in Sahih Bukhari, which is the most authentic collection of hadith according to our Sunni brothers, in volume 4, page 42. He says, فَغَلِبَتْ فَاطِمَةُ بِنْتُ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمْ. Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet, she became angry with the first caliph. فَهَجَرَتْ أَبَا بَكْرِ. She left the first caliph. They were talking before that. فَلَمْ تَزَلْ مُهَاجَرَتُهُ حَتَّى تُوفْيَتْ. She was angry with the first caliph until her demise. So this is the, viewpoint and the, approach of Lady Fatima Zahra salamu alayha toward the first caliph. She has been angry with him for a couple of weeks or months, and she didn't become happy with him before her demise. And other narrations, again, in Sahih Bukhari, tells us that the anger of Fatima al-Zahra salamu alayha means the anger of the Prophet, and the anger of the Prophet means the anger of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, again, Sahih Bukhari, volume 4, page 210, the Holy Prophet says, Fatima bad'atun minni, Fatima is a part of me, فَمَنْ أَغْلَبَهَا أَغْزَبَنِي. The one who makes her angry, it is as if he has made me angry. So these are two narrations in Sahih Bukhari, the most authentic.
Enough.
Yeah. It means that Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha has been angry with the first caliph. How is it possible for Imam Sadiq alayhi salam to forget about this? And Na'udhu Billah says that I'm boastful of being from the generation of the same person, from Abu Bakr, who made my mother angry. It doesn't make any sense.
Made the daughter of the Prophet angry, who then in turn made the Prophet angry and in turn made Allah angry.
Exactly.
It makes no sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. There are some other narration in this regard that, for example, it's been mentioned in Al-Imama wa Siyasa by one of the famous Sunni scholars, the Nawawi, volume 1, page 31, that Fatimatu Zahra Salamullahi alayha said that, addressing the Muslims, addressing the first two caliphs, she told them that, didn't you hear that my father said, Rida Fatima min Ridai wa Sakhat Fatima min Sakhati, the constant of Fatima is my constant and her anger is my anger. فَمَنْ أَحَبَّ فَاطُمَا إِبْنَتِي فَقَدْ أَحَبَّنِي. Whoever loves Fatima, he or she has loved me, and whoever makes her happy has made me happy, whoever makes her angry has made me angry. They said that the first two caliphs said that, yes, سَمِعْنَاهُ مِنْ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَعَلِيهِ وَسَلَّمْ. We have heard that from the Prophet. Then Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha said, فَإِنِّي أُشْهِدُ اللَّهَ وَمَلَائِكَتَهُ. I bring as witness Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His angels that أَنَّكُمَا أَسْخَدْتُمَانِي, that you, that is the first and the second caliph, you made me angry, وَمَا أَرْضَيْتُمَانِي, and then you didn't make me happy after that.
You didn't make me forgive you after you made me angry.
Yeah. وَلَئِنْ لَقِيتُ النَّبِيلَ لَأَشْكُوَنَّكُمَا إِلَيْهِ. If I meet my father, I will complain about you to my father.
So very big words.
Yeah, and the narration continues talking about how angry was Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha with the first two caliphs. According to some narration, it's been mentioned that the first caliph he cried because of the fact that he heard such words from Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha. So my point is that, of course, it doesn't mean we are allowing Shia to curse and to use bad words.
You cannot mention that at all here.
Yeah, it's something else. The point is that, but we are not negating the fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam, Fatimah Zahra salamullahi alayha, according to Sunni sources, they have been angry with the these caliphs.
They were not on friendly terms.
Yeah. Mm. So we are not compromising on this issue. This is a reality. This is a fact in the history. So with that, we cannot claim that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has been boastful of being from this generation.
From a purely narrative and historical perspective, it makes no logical sense.
Exactly. When it comes to Imam Ali alayhi salam, again, we have some narrations in Sunni sources which tell us that Imam Ali alayhi salam was also angry with the first caliph. I mean, it's not, this issue of successorship after the Holy Prophet is not something that we can take lightly. It was very important. So this right was usurped. And
it was taken by force.
Exactly. And we cannot claim that Imam Ali alayhi salam has been happy with that. He for sure knew that the whole history would have been changed after this wrong decision. According to this narration in Sahih Muslim, volume 5, page 152, it's been mentioned that when the Holy Prophet passed away, Abu Bakr says that, I'm the